Welcome back. Well, I hope you didn't leave us in the break. So yes, welcome to our last Grand Family session on book arts and book studies, or book arts in studies of the book. So which will be led by Adam Smyth, professor of English literature and history of the book at Oxford. Thank you.
Great, thanks so much, Justine. It's really nice to be here. I really enjoyed that last session. So many questions still to ask and conversations to continue. So we're going to have a discussion now about book studies and book arts and the relationship between the two. I think Agrippa will be present and bubbling around, but we'll also think about other projects and other work by our speakers too, and perhaps widen things out a little bit and think about where we place Agrippa perhaps in relation to certain kinds of tradition and other work that's going on. So what I'll do, I'll introduce our speakers, and then they're each going to talk for about 10 minutes about their own work and their own thinking and the way in which book studies and book arts can connect. And then we'll have a little discussion between the three of us for about 20 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to your teeming urgent questions that you'll have for the last 10 or 15 minutes. That's the plan. So let me introduce our two speakers. Russell Marrett is a book artist and letter designer working in New York City. Russell began printing in San Francisco as a teenager and set up his own press at the Center for Book Arts in New York in 1993. And since then, he's been printing and publishing and designing type in really fascinating ways. He was awarded the Rome Prize in Design from the American Academy of Rome in 2009. Has been printer in residence at a number of institutions, including here in the Bodleian Library, the Bibliographical Press in 2017. And Russell's books and manuscripts are held in public and private collections throughout the world. So we're really thrilled to have Russell here to talk about his own bookmaking work. Jill Partington is an academic and book artist. Jill is a fellow in book history at the Institute of English Studies in London, where she teaches and writes about 20th century and contemporary book cultures, focusing particularly on the blurry hybrid space between book and art. And Jill's published on artists including Tom Phillips, John Latham, Book Burning, and The Strange Fate of the Dust Jacket. And Jill's current research project is Page Not Found, a study of the outer limits and the unexpected histories of the page as a space for meaning. Jill's also the co-founder and co-editor of Inscription, the Journal of Material Text. And Jill's creative work, her artist's book work, has been exhibited at the Bodleian Library in the recent Fantastic Sensational Books exhibition at Shandy Hall in Yorkshire, former home of Laurence Sterne, of course. And the work has been commissioned and acquired by the Beinecke Library at Yale. Okay, I realize we didn't decide who's going to go first. Who's going to go first? Jill. Okay, Jill, over to you.
Thanks, Adam. Well, here we are at day two of Agrippa Fest, or Agrippa Palooza, which is what Justine was calling it earlier. So we've been treating Agrippa as a very special kind of book object, almost a unique kind of book object whose singularity announces itself in the fact that it's designed to be read only once, whereupon it destroys itself. It does have printed pages, but as we've seen, these are quite unusual. They aren't meant to be read. They're a kind of DNA code. And actually, they're just a container for another medium, the famed digital diskette. So the book is, on one hand, distributed or dispersed, not quite sure which of its many elements is the actual book. And it's also hybrid. It's a piece of technology as much as a codex. It requires an operating system. And it's written in the language of zeros and ones, legible in the first instance only by a computer. But maybe what is most intriguing about Agrippa is not this uniqueness, the difference, but actually just the opposite. So maybe what's interesting are the odd similarities and the continuities that it has with books in general, and the perspectives that it opens up on the history of the book. And maybe like other artist books, it kind of pushes at the boundaries of the conventional codex, illuminating a whole alternative history of book use and book formats. So my argument, the point I'm going to try to make here, is that artist books have this capacity to unsettle our notions and our definitions of the book, and to kind of set in motion a chain of historical resonances that are useful from the perspective of book history. So here is a book from a different moment in time, a different publishing milieu, but one that is also, to echo Alan New's phrase from yesterday, a new media object. It's a technological device. I'll just do that again since people enjoyed it. It's a book that is in the Cambridge University Library collections. It's by Lothar Meggendorfer, who is as much a paper engineer as an author. He's a master of pull tab mechanisms and movable parts. So we're dealing here with the context of the movable book, Novelties for Children, that emerged in the late Victorian period, prompting a kind of technological arms race among publishers to innovate ferociously with the form and function of the book. So at this point, pages sprout all kinds of technological add-ons, levers, rivets, and other moving parts. And these were books that often specifically advertised themselves as mechanical books. They drew attention to their status as a kind of technology. And Meggendorfer's rhymes, often warn about the fragility of these mechanisms. So it says at the bottom there, if you pull too hard, you may spoil the show, or monkeys like mortals are frail, you know. So this, here's a page which is kind of actually referring to its own material workings, these kind of strangely reflexive pages. But often these warnings went unheeded, and here's a picture of the same book. There are places where it has come apart, where it no longer works, and where its damaged levers and workings are exposed, and they sort of look like sad broken machines, which in a sense of course they are. And even more uncanny, we're looking at a page opening that was never meant to be seen. So here is the page's hidden operating system, its back end, if you will, circa 1895. And the page is actually quite a complicated object in these mechanical books, both conceptually and topologically. And when you handle these kinds of pages, you can often feel that they are thicker than they should be. That something is concealed inside. It's not really a single leaf, although it may initially look like it. It's actually an envelope for moving parts. So we might think of the page by being defined precisely by visibility, that everything is on the surface because the page is just a surface. But in this case, it's doubled, it's deceptive. There are actually four sides, but only two are visible, and there's a secret hidden compartment. And so, like Agrippa, these books have dummy pages whose real purpose is to be a housing or a mechanism. Now, in case you're not convinced by my analogy, I give you this, which is the insides of something called the Speaking Picture Book from 1893. So you can see that this is basically a box with a kind of a sort of Heath Robinson set of contraptions with wires and cardboard bellows and whistles and bits of wood. It doesn't actually speak as a cover. It doesn't actually speak, but it does make noises. So its nursery rhymes about farmyard animals are accompanied by sounds which are operated by pull cords, and each cord has a little arrow at the side of the page indicating which one to pull. Now, the sad thing is that I can't play the sound, but it's a kind of strangled squeak that is coming from the book at this point. It's supposed to be a donkey. So we talk about a book being printed and published, but this one is manufactured. This is a technical device that was subject to patent law. So its maker, Theodor Brand, registered a German patent for the book in 1878 and a British patent a year later. So here is a piece of Victorian kitsch that you wouldn't expect to encounter in relation to a high concept artist book like Agrippa. So I've thoroughly lowered the tone, but the similarities are undeniable. So here we have a hybrid multimedia object. It has pages that can be read, but they're also a kind of hollow receptacle. So you can see here that the top layer are the pages that can be turned, but the bottom is basically a box. It's a hollow receptacle. And inside that are the machinery and operating system that I showed you. Like Agrippa's floppy disk, it's a kind of outdated, semi-broken mechanism. It's had more than one reading, but still its workings are prone to self-destruct. It's quite fragile, and it's had a limited lifespan. So some of these cords are missing, some of them don't work at all. So you might argue at this point that these are these examples I've been showing you are exceptions and special categories of books, scenic detours on the roadmap of book history. So surely the conventional page has no such hidden operating system, no technical add-ons. Well, let's look at one. This is a page from Lawrence Stern's novel Tristram Shandy. So this is an early edition from the 1770s. We can see two things at the bottom here. The signature, E3, and then this catchword, invented, this kind of stray word at the bottom right. And these, in a way, are the kind of operating code of the page. The hand press book, the book in the kind of pre-industrial era, was a complex folding structure, a kind of origami, for which instructions were needed from printer to binder. The binder's job was to fold and cut the large printed sheets into gatherings. And the signatures are a kind of assembly instruction. So E3 here is part of the signature, the gathering E, which would then be sewn together with all the other gatherings to bind the book. And the catchword invented here, this is a peculiar kind of textual stutter in which the first word or syllable of each page is prefigured in the bottom right margin of the previous one. So if we turn the page, invented would be the first word on the next page. So again, assembling the book was prone to error, and these are the visual aids indicating that the correct page sequence is being followed. So we might think about these things as a kind of pre-digital source code, not designed to be read, it's not part of the narrative, and it's not even designed to be noticed. And yet, Nicholas D. Nace, in this little artist book called Catch Words, has done just that. He's extracted all the catchwords from Samuel Richardson's monumental epistolary novel, Clarissa, from 1748, and given them a book of their own. So he's allowed them to generate their own connections and meanings. And the result is this enigmatic little volume. And here I've put some slides up of what it looks like inside. So Richardson's story of tragedy, temptation, and moral virtue has been completely filleted. This is a much shorter book, but something of its emotional overwrought register lingers in these arbitrary sequences of catchwords, as perhaps does the endless exchange of letters, as you can see on the left. This book, Catchwords, it mirrors the original novel's construction, since Nace transforms each gathering into a page-long stanza and preserves each of its seven volumes as a canto. So it sort of turns the novel structure into a sort of poem using its catchwords. In a sense, it's like Clarissa, but in miniature. And then this miniaturization process repeats itself, since each page of Nace's book, as you can see here, has its own catchword, and these are then extracted to form a shorter second section, and then there's a third, and so on, as the words dwindle away to nothing in this kind of recursive structure. So a bit like reciting the text of Agrippa as a series of zeros and ones, which I gather from Justine was once a performance that took place. Nicholas Nace's book here, Catchwords, rereads only the operating code and ignores the narrative. So it's an artist book that reminds us that the page has always been a mechanism of sorts. We might not see it as such, but it's a technology and one that's always had its own operating system.
Thanks, Joe. Brief, I see.
Hello, I'm Russell Moret. I want to congratulate Justine and everyone who's put this conference together. I've just found it immensely inspirational. I've been aware of Agrippa since 1993 when I first met Kevin Bigos at the Center for Book Arts in New York. And that's the only time I'm going to refer to it in my little introduction. And I love the book, but you know, we're moving on. So I'm coming at this from the making side of things. I'm a book artist, fine press printer and publisher, and letter designer. And I spend about equal amounts of time studying and writing about those things as I do making them. And which means that I make quite a lot of different types of books. And so I'm just going to sort of give you an introduction about how my work relates to book studies, and then we'll get on with our discussion. So, I'm not projected. I'm looking at the screen thinking you're seeing what I'm seeing, and apparently you're not. I mean, this is beautiful. Thank you. So yeah, so as far as my different kinds of books, so books that vary from my noise series in the mid-90s, which was really just a reaction to the endless prattling on about legibility and the typographic literature, to my series of Promethean elegies inspired by Prometheus Bound, in which I made a number of books using historical page proportions, but in lieu of the text block, I put simply drawings made from candle smoke. Do I write and publish essays about typographic and epigraphic letter forms? In recent years, I've been moving into zine land and doing some street art. This is my redacted US Constitution. There's a deluxe version of that that you wouldn't want to staple onto a wall, but this is the $10 version. And then my most recent book is Colored Objects, which is an excerpt from Goethe's Theory of Colors. And it was very interesting seeing Jill deconstruct that movable book, because this is a movable book. These are Volvelles. There are six Volvelles on this page, and the whole book is constructed so that you only see two of every four surfaces, and there are all kinds of mechanisms that are a real pain in the ass to make. And hopefully they won't break too soon. Hopefully I'll die before they break. That's the goal. Anyway, but the my general belief, or my feeling, is that anyone who endeavors to make something automatically is in dialogue with and interacting with history, the history of that medium, whether they know it or not, or they want to be or not. And I just happen to like that aspect of it. So I'm just going to go through two quick projects. This is my book, Interstices and Intersections, or An Autodidact Comprehends a Cube. It's 13 propositions from Euclid, one from each book of the Elements of Geometry, which are paired with personal essays that I wrote in response to them, and then I illustrated both Euclid and my texts. And the thing that is wonderful about Euclid from the perspective of book arts is that every proposition in Euclid has a component diagram that explicates the text. And you can't really, it's very hard to understand the book without the images. And those diagrams were developed in the manuscript era and carried over into the printed book. So if you were to go up into the reading room of the Bodleian and call up the Dorville Euclid from 888, you'd notice that the diagram for Proposition 1317 looks strikingly similar to the one printed in 1948. And I don't know of any other text, any other book that has this consistent millennia-old tradition of text and image parody. And because of the sort of stasis of that, it has provided a springboard for a lot of printers to get creative. And so when I was making this book, I was worried that because I love patterns, that I would respond primarily to the diagrams, and I wanted to get to know the text better. So I chose two things to do. One was to look at over 200 historical editions of Euclid, and two of my favorites are the one published by John Day in 1570, which in book 11 has paper fold-ups of the three-dimensional objects that Euclid is describing, so the reader can actually make them. This is 1570. And of course, there's Oliver Byrne's Chromatic Euclid, which is wonderfully legible, but entirely non-Euclidean because he assigns values to the propositions, which is a no-no. And then the other thing I decided I wanted to do was to, I figured the best way to start was to make a 13-volume manuscript in which I tried to prove every proposition in the book. And that way I would get, my essays would relate specifically to their content. So this slide gives you a sense of some of the preparatory work for the edition. And then along the bottom here, these colorful books are my manuscripts. So that's one way I interact with book history or book studies. The other is in my alphabet design. So on November 30th, 1996, I was looking at this drawing and I was seized with a sudden vision for a typeface for the Book of Job. I had no training in type design. I have no facility for calligraphy, but it was there clear as day. The next morning I got out of bed, christened myself a type designer, and started teaching myself how to draw letter forms. And the only technique I really understood was geometry. So I started there, and I never made a type for the Book of Job. I ended up making, this was the first of a series of additioned geometric alphabetical manuscripts that I made. So I made 7 copies of this. Each one is drawn and painted. But ever since then, I've been sort of curious, and I've thought a lot about what made me suddenly feel the need to design my own typefaces. And so when you think about the history of the typographic book, what you're really thinking about is the history of type design. And so if we look at these books, like the Gutenberg Bible, Nicholas Jensen, Aldus Manutius, Robert Grandjean, forgive my French pronunciation, Fournier Lejeune, John Baskerville, John Battista Bodoni, and William Morris. Now, all of these books have many planes on which they're interesting, but from the standpoint of letter design, what's unique about all of these people is that they started with a backward glance toward alphabetical history, and then they made new alphabets that were resonant of their time and place, that were of their own art historical moment. And so the reason we know these people's names is in the typographic world is because they did that. We would not know who they were, I'm convinced, if they didn't. And the problem that this presents for a letterpress printer in the late 20th and early 21st century is that most of the metal typefaces available to us were designed 100 or more years ago. The last commercially available typeface released by Monotype until recent years was over 50 years ago. And so although these typefaces had a dramatically important impact on the typography of the 1920s and 30s, I believe that the proposition that I should use them in my book is as absurd as the proposition that Grandjean should have used Gutenberg's type. These are beautiful examples of machine age thought and design, and they have nothing relevant to say, in my opinion, to the digital age. And so one of the things that interests me is that idea of how people at different points in time view the past. So these people were making, they looked at the past. You can tell from the correspondence and the literature around these typefaces that they viewed the past as something that could now be corrected by their machines. Whereas I view the past as a digital person, as something where I can embrace the imperfections of the past and recreate them in a way that I happen to prefer the pre-industrial printed page. And so when I look at pre-industrial typefaces, I don't want to correct them. I don't want to align them. I want to have them warts and all. And so in 2015, I had the opportunity to sort of test a theory of mine. The theory was that monotype faces look the way they did, not because the machines required them to be standardized, but because the operators of the machines believed that they should be standardized. And so I started working with a group of people at the Type Archive in London, people who started working at British Monotype in 1945, 1952, and 1965. And I worked on a historic revival of my own that is really sort of grotesque. I love it, but you know, some people really hate it. And I developed a workflow where I started with a digital typeface, used digital technology to engrave patterns, which were then used to engrave using the original Monotype machines to engrave punches, strike matrices, and then cast type. And And when I gave the 100 drawings for the Hungry Dutch typeface to Graham Shepherd, who was my main collaborator and a great, great, just brilliant man, he said that Monotype would have rejected all 100 of the drawings, and I knew that I was on track. And so we made them, and because I had a digital master, I was able to see that they were able to recreate exactly what I had designed. And so there was no need for that fiddling. So anyway, this just gives you an idea of how I, you know, so much of the work that I make is rooted in the history of the book, but is, you know, my goal in studying the history of the book is to make work that is of my time, of our time. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks both. So fascinating. The page as a technology with its own codes and logic and conventions. That's a really helpful idea. And the book as part of a conversation with history, looking back on history from our present moment rather than the treatment of history. Really, really helpful ideas. I've got a few questions I wanted to ask. Before we open things up. The first, I was thinking about reading and readers, and in your case, Jill, whether individuals interacting with those fantastic late 19th century children's books are reading at all, or whether we need a different term or a different kind of understanding of what's going on there. And then, Russell, I was looking at your piece that responds to Goethe's theory of colours too, with the Vervels. I wonder what reading has become, or whether you have readers at all, or whether you have some different kind of relationship. Maybe, Jill, you could say a little bit about what people are doing to these fantastic monkeys.
I don't know. They are doing something different, but I don't know what name we would give it. That I think this is the problem.
Because it's multi-sensory.
It definitely involves, it's definitely tactile and visuals. But I think what that means is that the term reading has to be revisited in the light of that. And I mean, I think that, you know, that seems to be a process that is going on in the history of reading, the history of the book, that we're thinking about it as a kind of something embodied. But I also think that there's another thing, which is like the history of breaking things while you're reading them. And I was looking at those Vervels and thinking, oh, that's so beautiful, but I'd be scared to touch them.
You asked a lot actually in that question, but first the Vervels are meant to be handled, you know, the books are meant to be handled. I don't know if the Bodleian wants people, you know, trying to test the limits of them, but the book is built to last with the understanding that it's not a commercial object and it's not going to be handled all that much. I do find that people, some people read my books. Why anyone would pay what I charge for my books and not read them, I don't understand, but some people do that and they're free to do that. But for me, and this is the first book I've made with movable parts in it, and the reason I did it was because Goethe's theory of colors is really fun to read because he is Goethe, but all of the science in it is wrong. The thing that's right is that all of the chromatic phenomena that he describes are real. He just didn't get the science right. And so the book is very, it's full of his, you know, exuberance for playing with things and experimenting and everything. And so I basically made a children's book for grown-ups where I, rather than illustrating what he was talking about, I made the book so that you can perform the experiments he describes. And whether people read that or not, I don't know. I mean, I find that the greatest agents for people encountering my work are librarians. That books that go into private collections are usually seen very rarely, and but books that go into libraries, librarians actually show to people, and there's this echoing out of these, you know, small editions. Someone said, I realized he had the numbers wrong because of the advertising, that there were only 200 copies of Agrippa. I mean, these things are so hard to make. They're limited by necessity, not by a desire to make them. So anyway, librarians are the ones who sort of get them into the public consciousness.
That's great. You mentioned children then, and I wanted to ask Jim about these as children's books. There seems to be, in Sarah, like say, is a children's books and book history. Why does it matter to you that these are books for children, or are they books for children? They look like they are, and is there a certain kind of inventiveness and radicalism that's going on there that's to do with that?
Yeah, I think it is important that they're books for children, because as I mentioned in the talk, that this period in particular is a sort of a period of constant reinvention and kind of experimentation with the form of the book, but it doesn't happen in the realm of art, or I mean the concept of the artist book was way in the future, but it doesn't it's not even happening in the realm of kind of high culture or art. It's happening in a space where there's more license to produce kitsch and novelty and gimmicks. And because of that, they are they sort of don't get the credit they deserve for their inventiveness. But I also think that it's important because the readership is assumed to be interactive in a different way, and that they will want to kind of pull tabs and play. So it assumes that reading is a kind of physical embodied activity. But the interesting thing about both the examples that I showed is that even though they're quite broken, they entered the collections of Cambridge University Library under legal deposit. So they were never owned by children. So they've been broken because adults have been playing with them in the collection. So, I mean, make of that what you will. But I did run a course recently, a short course about movable books. And the final session was a sort of, hands-on session where the room was constantly quiet, and there were 12 adults absolutely engrossed playing with these books. And so I think they are intended for children, but there's something about that physical interaction which is kind of, it's hard to resist once you kind of engage with them.
That's what you're going to say about children and your books, since you mentioned them.
Well, yeah, I mean, my experience is the same as Jill's with adults, and people tend to think of the book collecting public in the fine press artist book world as being sort of, they are erudite and everything else, but it's amazing how people light up when a book does something unexpected. With the Euclid, for instance, it's a very simply just, it's a two-sided accordion. And when you get to the end of proposition 7, you turn the book over and you continue. And every time that I would do that at a book fair, someone would go, you know, and the same with the Goethe, they love it. There's a pair of blue glasses and a pair of green glasses, and you take them out and look at the world, and people get excited, and it is a kind of license to be playful in a world that is thought to be, you know, in some, well, at least in public portrayal, is suffocatingly fun, you know. So yeah.
And do you think readers in 1570, that amazing John Day, was there a similar frisson and delight when they saw those amazing working with this to the same effect?
I can't see how there wasn't, but who knows? I mean, the other thing that book has is it has a bunch of templates for cutting out structures that you can then fold into the Platonic solids and a number of other. And I'm looking for a copy that I've never seen one that has any of them cut out, because I would love that. To know that someone would just took their scissors to it and was like, I'm going to make a dodecahedron. And,
a couple of final questions before we can maybe open it up. One, maybe for both of you, but perhaps first for Jill, is about the relationship between the normal book or the conventional book and then the creative or inventive or aberrantal strange book. And in your talk, you were collapsing that divide in lots of ways, but is there still a language of normal, regular, orthodox books that's in contrast to kind of self-reflective works that you are talking about?
Well, I suppose the answer I want to give is no, because there's something about these exceptions that bring out kind of the oddities and quirks of the book, but also the more you dig, the more widespread the exceptions seem, and the harder it is to find, you know, something that where's this kind of normal conventional book. And I think listening to Matt Kirschenbaum's lecture yesterday about the how the digital book is produced, like the post digital paperback, something that we kind of all take for granted, there was some, you know, there turned out to be something very odd and uncanny about the production of that, and, you know, what it is and how it comes to be. So I think the more closely you look, the more oddities and quirks you find in even the most, you know, conventional book object.
And maybe for both of you, but the final point to bring it back to the quick one. So where does that leave Agrippa, where do we place that? Do we, are the traditions that it fits into, is it dramatizing in an extreme form the kind of qualities of damage, of abuse, of history, books as carriers of code, etc., that you were talking about in different ways? Does it dramatize them in an extreme form, but in a way, in a representative way? Is it an outlier at the end of it, when we start to look at it through book studies and artist book today?
I just think of the conversation we were having over lunch about how theatrical it is. I mean, it looks like, you know, something that was forgotten on the set of Indiana Jones or something, you know, and you open it up and there's this shroud and it's burned and it's, you know, it's very, and then the whole theatrical, you know, it was meant as a spectacle, you know, clearly this performance of, you know, the transmission, we're going to like send it out into the world and it's going to be, you know, and that's wonderful, I think, but but it does, you know, it's something that didn't come up so much in the discussion of it, I think, that it is very much a theatrical piece of work that but as far as it's, I mean, I'm really hard pressed to think of an artist book that, you know, if you're doing a sort of vertical study of the history of you know, a silo that where Agrippa is at the bottom, and I'm really hard pressed to think of an artist book that directly springs out of that. I mean, it happened at the time, you know, Matt Kirschenbaum showed a bunch of those, you know, book is dead articles that were coming out around that time. And it happened at the time where you kept hearing about, you know, these new digital forms of reading that we were going to encounter with hyperlinks and everything. But, you know, people just want to read a story. You know, it's like none of that really came to be, except in very, you know, limited small corners of the reading public. And so I guess I'm just going to ramble after that.
That's fine.
Yeah.
That's great. But, yeah. Okay. Thank you. But we have about